Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 6th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you this week still again from Phoenix as we're all sitting here in stay-at-home time. And we'll be talking this week a little differently than we usually do. One of the things that's happening is, of course, we're not getting tons of new developments in terms of the standard sorts of things we talk about here, which would be things like cases and rulings and other items. What we are getting is a very rapid-fire changing situation related to the CARES Act and, to a lesser extent, to the extended due date issues. So what I want to do this week is say, why don't we take a step back and let's kind of look at where we stand. As of the time I record this, this is being recorded at 9 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on Sunday, April the 5th. And I say that because things change very, very rapidly. And so you have to kind of understand when this was recorded to understand what the time frame is and then update it for things that have happened since that time. What we're going to discuss today, though, is basically what we got this week in terms of guidance on the CARE Act. Right? What do we know about this week? And we're going to take a look at the highlights. Like I said, not many standard developments, lots of issues related to the CARES Act. We're getting guidance from many locations, and most tax CPAs I know of are knee-deep in the middle of a non-tax issue now, which is going to be the PPP loan programs, the Payroll Protection Program loans, basically because clients are going to have to make decisions on, do they want to go there? Do they want to go for the worker retention credit? And also just, it needs all kinds of payroll data and information, and they're turning to CPAs to help them compile some of this data. So somewhat, whether we like it or not, we've been drafted into becoming part of this program. So we're going to look at these key issues. Now, it's not a complete review of the act. We had I want to really thank the Idaho Society, the Arizona Society, and the people at Kaplan Financial Education. Each one was able to get together and it's simply a matter of time that I had available, but I could do ones that were free webinars offered there that we did 1 hour to members of those two societies. Plus, we did a general purpose nationwide one because it quickly became apparent, that there's only so much time. And so we got it done and all the pieces came together. So I really want to thank everybody that helped me there and get ourselves some stuff together. We put that on. Now, as we say, things change rapidly. So it was kind of interesting, between every webinar, we had at least something happen, that would change what you'd say in the next one. So the information's kind of interesting as we rolled forward. So still, I think, you understand where you sit at a point in time, and then you start following the changes in this thing, because that's how it's working at this point, right? We do that. So like I said, by the time you listen to this, there's a really good chance that something else will have happened, because we even had a development last night. On Saturday night, we had a development with the AICPA and their payroll coalition posting their position on proper computation of payroll costs for purposes of the maximum borrowing under the Payroll Protection Program loans, because there's been a significant amount of inconsistency among lenders when they started accepting applications and put out these worksheets about how that's computed. So yeah, things will have changed by the time you hear this. That's probably a given. So let's start talking about, I want to talk about some of the key provisions that we had in the law. And one thing that also, in addition to all the questions that you may be getting about the payroll protection program, we're also getting questions from our individual clients about those $1,200 checks, right, or payments to their bank account or whatever they are. So that's also become a continuing issue. So what I want to kind of do is walk through some of these provisions and just take a deep breath, and we're just going to kind of look at where we stand right now on these, okay? The recovery rebate, actually, because it's all tax-driven, is probably one of the simpler ones for most of us to deal with, even if our clients are thoroughly confused by it, because this whole thing exists inside the Internal Revenue Code. As we will discuss when we get to the loans, that's the Small Business Act, and that's an area that most of us are not really used to dealing with day in and day out. We may get involved with a loan application for a client for a, you know, a small, for an SBA loan at some point, but most of us don't get involved with a whole bunch of them. And it's like, so we're probably not, we don't know the ins and outs of the Small Business Act the way we know the ins and outs of the Internal Revenue Code. So the recovery rebate, as I would say when I did sessions this past week, it's put together as a credit against 2020 taxes, but don't get tight, don't focus on that too much. Why? Because it's a credit against 2020 taxes because Congress needed a way to get money out to people. Okay? The organization that had the most information about bank accounts that it could get money to people the quickest because they're set up to do it is the Internal Revenue Service, right? They have all of that together. They are sending money to people every year since the majority of taxpayers get refunds, and now a majority of those are having direct deposit. So in essence, this is going to be the simplest way. So while it's a tax credit on 2020, don't think that if the 2020 credit turns out to be less than your prepayment, you're going to have to pay it back. The law very clearly makes it that's not going to happen. But let's talk about the basic credit, which I think the stats I saw were 83% of Americans should get the full basic credit. You go through the couple of bullet points I have on the screen right at the top. Don't go through the phase out. Just take that number and go with it and you're done. You know, that's what most will see. Over 90% will get at least some credit. So, you know, the rest, maybe another 10% or so, will go through the phase outs. And then that remaining about 7% will not get any payment because they're going to be over the limit. Okay. So now CPAs, our client bases, tend to be, you know, on the upper end of the scale. So we're more likely to see those with phase outs. Okay. Bottom line, basic credit, $1,200 if you filed your return any way other than married filing joint. If married filing joint, $2,400. Double. Makes sense. For every qualifying child, the term qualifying child means per the child tax credit. That means if the child is age 17 or older, you will not get this extra $500 for that child, even though that child is your dependent. But you will get that. So let's say you have a married couple. They have two children, age 9 and 10. They are going to get $3,400 by default. This does phase out if your income's too high. There is no low end on this. You can have no taxable income whatsoever. You will still get your full credit. But on the high end, we do lose it. It phases out by 5% for each dollar of AGI in excess of $150,000 if you're filing a joint return, $112,500 for filing a set of household, and $75,000 for all other taxpayers. So basically, it's going to go away when you're 20 times your credit over these phase-out levels. So for somebody who is single, you know, they are going to get a $1,200 credit. They had no dependents. So they get this $1,200 credit. You multiply that by 20. You get, you know, $24,000. So when they get to $99,000 of AGI, they will have no credit. Okay? Straightforward, where we go. Now, as I said, a 2020 credit wouldn't be terribly useful to get money in the pockets of people today. So, like we did back in 2008, we're going to go ahead and we are going to prepay this credit. Okay, but we're not going to pay it to certain people. So let's talk about a couple of issues here. And I forgot to add these on. So this is also who will not get a credit. Non-resident aliens don't get a credit. No surprise. Trust and estates don't get a credit. No surprise. The area where you're going to hear the most conversation is going to be over if somebody is eligible to be claimed as a dependent of another on their return. Now, the term in the law says eligible to be claimed. That means the answer to the question, can I take the kid off my return and let them, you know, claim themselves, answer is no. That's not how it works. If the kid's eligible to be claimed as a dependent on your return, then you can't just leave them off and get them the $1,200. Do I think that'll happen? Yeah, I think that'll happen with people. But is that allowed? No, it's not. Okay. Now, you also have to provide a valid ID number for the taxpayer, the spouse, and the children. If they're being adopted, we can use the adoption taxpayer ID. But if you're in the armed services, The requirement to have that adoption ID number can be waived in certain circumstances, the theory being, I assume, that the armed service member maybe has now become married to a resident of the country they're stationed in. That party may have a child. They may be in the process of adopting that child, so there may all work out, but obviously they don't have U.S. issues yet on that. So this will allow them to go ahead and still get the credit even if they don't have a valid ID number for the child, or even the spouse in this case, is the way it works. As long as one of them, as long as either the taxpayer or the spouse has a valid ID number, that's good enough, but only if you're a member of the armed services. So that's kind of a weird exception, but it's there. Now, the big thing is the advanced payment, right? Because this is what everybody's really going for right now. So you understand the basic credit, how it would work. The advanced payment is what you're going to get this year. It will reduce your 2020 credit, but not below zero, meaning you do not pay back the excess. So it will reduce your 2020 credit, but not below zero. So if in 2020 you didn't qualify for the credit based on the advanced payment calculation, but in 2020 your income has dropped, it's going to happen in a number of cases, and you do qualify for the full credit, you'll get the full credit against your 2020 taxes. Now, what's the advanced credit based on? It's based on your 2019 return if the IRS has processed it at the time they're going to send out the check. And I say send out the check, and I should put that in quotes. Really, the most likely way you'll get it quickly is if it's being electronically deposited. If they don't have the 19 information, they will send out the information. They'll compute the credit based on your 2018 information. In both cases, the law says they are to compute that what the credit would have been had the 20 law applied in that year. It'll be interesting to see how Treasury interprets things like that. If the child, let's say, is 16 in 2019, will be 17 in 20. It's not totally clear if Treasury is supposed to age the child into 20. It's also not totally clear, even if they potentially should, whether they could age the child into 20 in their systems and get this stuff out fast enough, right? So that's there. Now, if a taxpayer has filed neither a 19 nor an 18 return, there's still a chance they'll get a check. Treasury kind of changed directions on this one. The IRS said initially in their frequently asked questions this week, they said, well, if you didn't file a return for 18 or 19, even if you got Social Security, and you didn't need to file because you didn't have anything but the Social Security, you still have to go back and file a mini return on a website we'll put together to get the check. Now, the law had said that Treasury was going to look at the 1099 SSA or the similar document issued for railroad retirement benefits. And so 41 senators wrote a letter to the Treasury Secretary asking, what you're saying that these people have to go file something is not what we thought we voted for. And about 24 hours later, Secretary Mnuchin announced that, yeah, okay, we're going to go back and look at the 1099 SSA. So if you have a client who didn't file for 18 or 19, wasn't required to file, and they get Social Security, then they're supposed to get the check and they'll look at depositing it in the bank account that they're depositing Social Security in, right? That's the key. Now, if your client, however, didn't have to file a return but did not get Social Security, those people do need to file something in order to get this. I mean, and that's going to be presumably on that IRS website, which I may have seen was kind of up. It's supposed to be up shortly, right? So we'll see how that goes. I haven't confirmed that it's running. So we'll just leave it at the fact that we don't know if it's running currently, but theoretically it would work. Okay, they're going to use the bank account. They can deposit it directly into a bank account if the taxpayer has authorized the federal government to deposit money in an account, and that authorization was effective after January 1st of 2018. So if you had your 18 refund deposited in a bank account, even if your 19 return you owe tax, in theory, Treasury can use the 18 bank account, right? If you never told the IRS your bank account because you're scared that, that you don't got to tell them your bank account number, which I always found to be funny because I look, they're writing a check to pay the tax. The bottom of the check has all the account information, but I'll leave it at that. We'll go with that. Everything you need to get in their bank account is on the check, is what I'd say. But you know, if they've never done it, then or if they and apparently if they never got a refund, it's not clear. I'm assuming Treasury may assume that if you authorize them to take the money from the account, that they can assume they're authorized to put it in the account. But again, the law didn't really word that way, so we'll see what happens. Now, the key issue is, and this is what we're spending an inordinate amount of time on clients, especially individual clients who are going whack over this. Well, they might be better off filing a 19 return if they don't have it done yet. Or maybe their 19 return would be a lower, you know, would be lower. It may, oh my gosh, I filed my 19 return, but 18 was a lower year. Well, can we take away the 19 return? Okay, back up, calm down. Remember, whether it's 18 or 19 only matters if the return that's going to be used, if nothing else happens, is one that, you know, is in the phase out range or above the phase out range. And the other return, let's say, so the 18 return, you were above the phase out range, you know, the entire phase out range, you get nothing. 19, you had a bad year, so you get the full credit. Then yes, if we can put the 19 return in, you'd be better. But for the vast majority of clients, they are either below the range for both years, who cares, or they're way above it for both years. Who cares, right? It's irrelevant if it's 18 or 19. Those that it does matter, again, we do not know at the moment, if, you know, what, obviously at some point we have to cut off and stop counting 19 return filings to get these payments out. We do not have any announcement yet from Treasury if there is a future date that they know of that's going to be that cutoff date, or even if that date's already passed, which is always possible. Now, when the IRS does put the money in the bank account, they will mail a notice to the taxpayer when the payment is made, along with information, and it's going to go to your last known address, with information to contact in case, hey, wait, you say you put $2,400 in my bank account. I don't see $2,400. You know, what's up? So there'll be a contact point for that. Okay, that's key. That's the big one. The other one for individuals that you're going to be talking with a lot of clients about is the waiver of the requirement minimum distribution. No required minimum distribution for 2020 from a retirement plan or from an IRA. Okay, those are not required. For IRAs, if the taxpayer, let's say, you know, took the money out, they've already taken their RMD. If they did so in the last 60 days, it seems pretty clear they can put it back in with no questions asked. If it's more than 60 days ago, which is true for a lot for people who just take it out first of the year, you know, vast majority of clients wait till the end, but there's those that just take it out immediately, you know, early on so they don't risk a 2008 meltdown again. Hey, we did that again, didn't we? So since they don't risk that with, you know, having to take out so much higher percentage of their account, they take it out early. Those clients, if can they put it back in? I'd say it technically at this point, no. But do I think it's likely that Treasury will issue some relief in this area? Yes, because the IRS already has the authority to grant relief from the 60-day rollover rule. So it would seem to me that the IRS could fairly easily blanket relief in a notice or revenue procedure for people that meet the proper conditions to put the money back in by some date, probably the end of the year. You know, they restore the money to the account. It will not be considered to be a late rollover and all will be well. Also, if you had a taxpayer who hit the required beginning date on April of 2020 because they turned 70 and a half in 2019, if they didn't take the distribution in 19, then it's waived for 20. If they took the distribution in 19, sorry, you don't get to put that back in. Right? Well, you'd be more 60 days past anyway. And secondly, there's no relief for that. But what it means is nobody is required to take money out of their retirement account in 2020, at least per federal law. Now, some of this, we talk about qualified plans, will depend on plans being, you know, being willing and going to amendments. And some of these provisions are not clear whether the law mandates that plans have to make these changes or whether the law simply allows a plan to make a change. Those of you who deal with qualified retirement plans know that your plan has to have, you know, you have to operate according to this language, and that language has to be, you know, in line with what the law says can be in the plan, but you don't have to. You know, for instance, the simplest one is a plan loan. The law allows you to offer loans to participant, but nothing requires that a plan offer a loan to participant. So the question is, if a plan offers loans, do they have to now do the one-year deferral? Do they have to now offer 100 grand and 100% rather than 50% and 50 grand of the accrued vested benefit? And the answer is, I don't know, it's totally clear. I'm thinking on the loans, the answer is in terms of offering the bigger one, I think that may very well be no, because obviously you never had to offer a loan at all. On the question of the one-year deferral of payments, that one's not quite as clear at whether it's a mandatory or not. A lot of that will have to await Treasury guidance on that issue. Okay, let's talk about the SBA loan programs. The big thing to remember there, as we talk about that this week, these loan programs go on top of the existing Small Business Act. That is not something we as tax CPAs are really, really comfortable with. That's very important to understand. Secondly, remember, when you see terms here, unless they specifically reference the Internal Revenue Code and tax definitions, don't assume your tax definitions hold. For instance, let's talk about something as simple as a disregarded entity, single member LLC. Well, don't assume if you have an LLC that it will necessarily, your tax election would necessarily be accepted. I think it will be in a lot of these cases, but again, we have tax rules and those rules apply for tax, and this is a whole different section of the U.S. Code. If you're reading, and these changes go on top of the existing Small Business Act, just like those tax law changes I mentioned go on top of the existing Internal Revenue Code. And because of that, you have to kind of remember anything in the Small Business Act that was not specifically changed by this law applies to these programs. So you have to be careful and, you know, try to remember it's not just the bill. And probably it'd be really helpful if you can to work with somebody who has worked with small business loans in the past and knows the basics of the SBA programs, and we can start inserting the proper parts of this in, because it's getting confusing enough. And remember, it is going on top of an existing body of law. Now, the big thing that happened late this week was the Small Business Administration released the interim final rules on Section 1102 of the CARES Act, which are the Payroll Protection Program loans, and Section 1106, which is the debt forgiveness, right? The key changes in those final rules, which means these are things that you may think work differently, but because you heard discussions earlier in the week, right? And that could even be that my sessions on Thursday morning and Thursday afternoon, right? I did those for Idaho and Arizona on Thursday, and these were issued after those sessions. So these are changes even from those sessions. I told you everything's changing. You know, keep up. There are some changes from what we had. A key one, we were told by Treasury initially the interest rates on these loans would be 0.5% if you don't get them forgiven, or any extent, any part that's not forgiven. That was raised to 1%. Why did that happen? The reports were the community banks especially had told Treasury that their cost of borrowing funds is more than 0.5%. So if they just get 0.5% for the loans, they, you know, they're going to lose money on every one. So Treasury agreed to raise it to 1%. So if you heard about these loans being 0.5%, you even see articles stating that, they were correct, kind of, at least for like 24 hours, and then they weren't correct because we had a change of heart. As well, the term of the loan is not 10 years. That was a maximum term. You might have seen that in various places because that's what the law says the maximum could be. But the SBA has said everybody gets the same terms, and for these loans, it'll be 2 years, not 10. Okay, maximum is 10. 2 is less than 10. That's okay. So we can do that. They tried to clarify the independent contractor rule, but it's added a lot of confusion. It's still not wholly clear if a, and especially because the problem you're going to find when you read this interim final rule, it reads almost as if one person wrote the section that is the guide to borrowers, and a totally different person wrote the section as a guide to the banks and lenders, and they never read each other's work before this came out, because we see some inconsistencies, big ones. On independent contracts, on the borrower's side, you will see references to, you know, you qualify for this loan if you had employees or you paid a 1099 contractor. Okay, so we could add those in. But if you read the borrower's side, you keep getting the reference that no, your contractors don't count, right? Contractors have to go get their own loan. You know, Senator Marco Rubio, who chairs the committee that oversees this in the Senate, he had a very interesting, like 13 tweet line. We're governed by tweets these days. A 13-tweet line that went through the open issues on the program. And he did say that this is one of the key unresolved issues. And he posted later on his own, you know, his own Senate website, a notice about how we've resolved some of the issues in his tweet. And he did have a note still today. The independent contractor issue is one that needs guidance from Treasury and has not yet been resolved. So keep an eye for that. The testing for the loan amount, there's a real problem there. Like I said, this is, again, the difference between the guidance for borrowers and the guidance for lenders. The guidance for borrowers say that we're going to test based on, you know, the prior 12 months, which would suggest you're applying today, you'd look at April 1st, 2019 to March 31st, 2020 as your 12-month period. However, the loan application that the SBA put up and the guidance to borrowers, loan application says 2019 is what you provide. The guidance to borrowers says 2019 is what you confirm. So again, inconsistency there. And that even adds the other problem with payroll withholdings. Okay. There's that weird provision that we'll discuss very briefly here about having to, that payroll costs do not include, you know, payroll taxes paid under three, you know, chapters of the Internal Revenue Code. Or I said, you know, three, I forget, subchapter, I got to remember the catch here. Whichever parts of the Internal Revenue Code, which is useful. Okay, it tells us that it doesn't cover those three. But here's the problem. One of those they tell us it doesn't cover is the federal withholding taxes, income tax withholdings, which suggests that you would, that the calculation would exclude the federal withholding tax and the FICA taxes and Medicare taxes withheld, that we would have to take that out. Well, you know, that seems a little weird as to why you would, but you do. You know, that's the key. Now, it had a reference to covered period, that you had to do this for the covered period. Now, this is where we got confusion, and I got confused here too. The covered period, you know, we have different, each section has different covered periods under the code. And you had to go find the specific cross-reference. You know, they keep using this term covered period. They should have said something like payroll cost covered period or forgiveness covered period or used other specific terms. They didn't. They kept reusing this term covered period, and then there'd be a definition somewhere you had to find that was the covered period. And it wasn't clear, I think, especially if you're reading quickly, that covered period was different for all of these. So a lot of people got confused. But the one thing that's very clear in final regulations is if there is removing of federal withholdings from payroll costs, it only runs from February 15, 2020 to June 30, 2020. So if 19 is the year we're testing, we would use gross payroll. The AICPA, like I said, posted a notice last night that tells us that, you know, with their payroll coalition, that they're saying, look, lenders, this is, you test 2019 and you use gross payroll and you don't take withholdings out. Now, there's still the problem that that time period will cover your payback period. But Senator Rubio indicated, it's one of those tweets, that it wasn't Congress's intent to have the business have to, you know, cover the federal withholdings. And the AICP also suggested in the postings on their pages that their talks with Congress has been that that's not the intent. It may need to fix, because I think the law as you read, it's kind of tough to read it not saying, saying you don't do that. But apparently, if we've got congressional intent, and usually if all the, you know, if the chairs and ranking members of all major committees involved and the, you know, House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader all sign off and say, yeah, that's a problem, we'll fix it, you know, they'll go that route. So hopefully we'll get that going. Now, the major banks were kind of slow to accept applications, kind of slow as being nice about it. Friday, a lot of banks were not accepting applications. As well, some banks were only accepting applications from customers that had a checking account and a business loan with them. Senator Rubio was protesting that in his tweets on Saturday, and the banks, some of the banks have backed off. Now Bank of America will also consider you if you just have a checking account, business checking account with them. You had one on February 15th, as long as you don't have a loan relationship with another bank. This goes a lot. The reason for this is a lot the bank, the banking fraud issues they have to check for making sure not to get involved with money laundering and the like. Yeah, you have certain easier ways to do it if you have an existing customer. So that's part of the deal. So let's quickly go over the whole Paycheck Protection Loan in case you hadn't been following. But those were some of the key changes. It's a new category of SBA loans, and you can convert a disaster loan taken out on or after January 31st to this type of loan. If it's not forgiven, you get preferable repayment terms, 1% interest rate to your terms. Now, if you take this loan out, you must certify. And I think this is one thing people, you know, sometimes are skipping by. They see it as free money. It's like, well, not really totally. Keep an eye on this. You have to certify to get it, and everybody gets it. That the uncertainty of current economic conditions make necessary the loan request to support the ongoing operation of the eligible recipient. That is something they are going to certify under penalty of perjury is true. And it appears they are looking at the issue of ongoing operations kind of as being read to say that we are going out of business unless we get this, right? We're going to keep operating if you do this, or at least keep paying our employees. Now, you often say that you acknowledge the funds are going to be used to maintain payroll, make mortgage payments, lease payments, utility payments, and retain workers, that the recipient does not have an application pending for a loan for this purpose and duplicate amounts applied for this purpose. I have another application out there. And during the period from February 15, 2020, ending on December 31st, 2020, you've not received amounts under this subsection for the same purpose and duplicative amounts applied for or received under a covered loan. Now, that third one about not having another loan application outstanding is a problem because there have been reports of some small businesses because their banks are slow and they had a way to do it with two banks. They're like putting two, three, four, how many applications in there. That's a potential problem that I see. It could get them denied totally. So I'd be a little careful with doing that. Now, the max loan is 2.5 times average payroll cost for the prior year. Plus, if you have a refinance disaster loan, it can be no more than $10 million. Now, payroll costs include a number of costs, right? Those costs include, per the law, salary, wage, commission, or similar compensation, payments of cash, tip, or equivalent, payment for vacation, parental, family, medical, or sick leave, allowance for dismissal or separation, payments required for provision of group health benefits, including insurance premiums, payment of any retirement benefit, or payment of state or local tax assessed on the compensation of employees. In addition, for independent contractors, at least that's how it's worded in the actual, you know, guidance, payroll costs include the sum of payments of any compensation to or income of a sole proprietor or independent contractor that is wage, commission, income, say net earnings, self-employment, or similar compensation. Yeah, we're not sure how that works. Again, does that mean you get to count your 1099-Cs? You know, theoretically, I could add my accounting firm and my law firm, right? You know, I don't care. They're a corporation. You know, they're still an independent contractor. Or is it only the ones that are, you know, that are unincorporated, or it's only the ones we don't. Yeah, it's a mess. We need serious clarification on that one. I'm going to tell you right now. Don't even try asking what the answer is. The answer is we don't know the answer. Payroll costs do not include compensation of an individual employee in excess of annual salary of $100,000 as prorated for the covered period. There's a little definition of whether that is salary only or if that's all payroll costs. We need some clarification there. Any compensation employee whose principal place of residence is outside the U.S., okay, that's good. And if you're getting paid qualified sick leave or family leave with the credit under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act we talked about earlier, that was the second coronavirus bill, that doesn't count either because that's already being paid for by the payroll tax credit. The weird one is payroll taxes under that also not including payroll costs are payroll taxes under Chapter 21, which is the Federal Insurance Contributions Act, Chapter 22, the Railroad Retirement Act, or Chapter 24. Now, the catch is, though, that one is for the covered period. And when you backtrack covered period under this, you discover covered period runs from February 15th of 2020 to June 30th of 2020. Okay? So, yeah, if we're going back to 19, then you understand. It is a total mess, right? Okay, we've got it. Just understand, there are unanswered questions. I don't have the answer. I expect, you know, we'll see what comes out. There's pretty decent hope that Monday, Treasury will start addressing some of these things, especially now that Senator Rubio kind of gave him a checklist of things to do. So we'll see how these get addressed on Monday. Now, the forgiveness. This loan, we gave you this loan based on 2.5% of your payroll, 2.5 times your average monthly payroll cost. Okay, we gave you that loan. Now, this loan can be entirely forgiven if during the 8 weeks following the date you receive that money, the money is used for payroll cost, and up to 25% of your forgiveness can be for costs of qualified mortgage interest, interest on a mortgage, interest only on a mortgage, that was in place before on or before February 15th, of 2020. Qualified rent on a rent that you on a lease you were in on or before February 15th, 2020. And qualified utilities, which includes utilities you were required to pay, you know, under contracts that were in place. You had contracts with the utility company on or before February 15th, 2020. Utility costs do include, there's a reference to transportation, and you can figure out what that one means. It's a little bit unclear. But there's also a reference like your internet service is considered a utility. Now remember, these can be no more than 25% of the total. 75% has to go to payroll costs. Payroll costs are what we talked about qualifying us for the loan with potentially that quirky rule about withholdings that we hope is going away. Okay. Now your forgiveness is reduced if you reduce your number of full-time equivalents. If your average full-time equivalents during this 8-week period is less than your average, your number of average full-time equivalents during the test, during the period you got the loan based on, then, you know, if they go down by 10%, 10% of your forgiveness goes away. Similarly, if you reduce an employee's salary by more than 25% during this period, then you're going to lose forgiveness on an amount equal to that excess reduction for the period. So, yeah, you know, you need to be careful. Now, this, however, can all be fixed if you restore those, get those back to the what they were during the testing period, if you get them back up there by June 30th of 2020. Okay. And also, any forgiveness is not taxable income. There is no attribute reduction like exclusions under Section 108. So, yeah, it just says it's not taxable income. Straight up, it told us. Now, again, how this works, this comes later. Right now, everybody's doing the first part, applying. This is the later part of it, but it's important understanding which benefit you should use. There's also a program you should be aware of called the Emergency EIDL Grants and Loans. And the private keeps referring to it as a loan and a grant back and forth at different times, which is, yeah, a little weird about how it goes, but it will take action. This is a $10,000 straight out payment that you can get. If you apply, say I've got an emergency, I need the money for this, you know, and to be eligible, you got to be not more than 500 employees. You have to operate a sole proprietorship with or without employees or independent contractor, cooperative with not more than 500 employees, ESOP not more than 500 employees, or a tribal business concern with not more than 500 employees. There are a few rules waived on these loans during it, right? We don't need to do it like no personal guarantee. On advances loans, not more than 200,000 during the covered period. Requirement that applicant needs to be in business for 1 year prior to the date is no longer in place. We can actually be in business. You know, just if we're in business on January 1st, 2020, that's good enough. You don't have to certify. You can't get credit elsewhere. There is a simplified approval process, and you get the 10 grand supposedly within 3 days after asking for the money. Okay, this program has been running. Now, you can use it, what you can use it for. You can use it for providing paid sick leave to employees unable to work because of the direct effect of COVID-19, but you can't double count this with your payroll tax credit, it would appear. Maintain payroll to retain employees during a business disruption or sustained slowdown. Meet increased costs to obtain materials unavailable from the applicant's original source due to interrupted supply chains. Make rent or mortgage payments. This one doesn't just say rent. It just doesn't say interest. And repaying obligations that cannot be met. Basically, existing obligations cannot be met due to revenue losses. Those are other loans. Now, if you take one of these, the only quirk is you don't have to repay it as long as you use it for those expenses, but it will reduce your debt forgiveness under PPP by 10 grand. So you take this, you lose part of your debt forgiveness. That's how it works. Okay. Now, clients are asking lots of questions about this. As I said, the PPP loan process, I will see how it runs on Monday. We'll see how the banks are working on Monday. We'll see how the Small Business Administration can process these requests on Monday. One stat I saw that causes some concern was that where the banks are now trying to submit this information to the SBA, they normally process about 60,000 requests a year. They are now going to be looking at processing well over that number of requests per day for a time period. And the key question you got to ask yourself is, can the system take the load? And, you know, and even if the systems, the computer system could take the load, you know, can't, are there enough people at SBA to be able to process all this stuff? Yeah, this could get interesting. Now, some of the business provisions that we have. Here's a trade-off to understand. There is an employee retention credit. You cannot claim this credit if you obtain a PPP loan. So if you apply for a PPP loan, you could ignore this section entirely. If you don't get that loan, that means not at all. Doesn't matter, forgiven or not. You get that loan, you can't take this. But if you don't get that loan, you can get this credit, which is equal to one half of the covered payroll. Okay. Now, you're eligible if you were carrying on a trade or business in 2020. Okay, good. And you either had a full or partial business suspension due to COVID-19. And the IRS does have a frequently asked questions page up now. If you're a McDonald's and you were ordered to close your, you know, your dining room, which almost everywhere now they're required to do so, if you're required to close your dining room, that's considered a partial business suspension due to COVID-19, so you'd be covered. Or if you had a substantial decline in gross receipts. Now, a substantial decline in gross receipts is we take a look at the quarter. So you take a look at, like, from January 1st to March 31st of 2020, compare your revenue then to January 1st to March 31st of 2019. If your gross revenue is down by more than 50%, that is now a quarter covered by this. Okay. Now, however, let's say that's probably not going to be your 50% quarter because most of the big shutdowns came the last half of March. Maybe in the Bay Area, things might have started early enough for this to work, but I have a feeling not many people will meet the first one. Probably the second quarter of 2020 will be the quarter that will be this issue, right? You then get to keep it to the quarter following the quarter that your revenue goes back to 80% of the prior quarter, okay? It is 50% of wages paid, and there's some, it depends on how they interpret the rule as whether related, you know, people who own over half the company, you know, or own a significant part are related to them, which ones of those you can't count because there is a limit there. But you get 50% of qualified wages. Qualified wages, if you have 100 or fewer employees, they include the wages you pay to anybody during this period, you get that 50%. With a caveat, we're capped at 10 grand per employee for wages going to count for this whole period, for all the quarters involved. Now, if you are above 100 employees, you only get a credit for people you're paying who perform those services for you. Okay, so basically you're paying people who you're just paying to stay home, right? They're not doing any services. So small business gets it for everybody. Business from 100 is going to get it essentially for the people that they're just paying who are staying home, okay? And obviously, if you take a PPP loan, you can't get it all. So there's basically three categories of employers we can look at here. Those that have 100 or fewer employees and how this would work for them. Those who have 101 to 500 employees and are going to consider the PPP loan or this, and those above 500 where there's no PPP loan option, so this is their benefit. Okay, that's how it's going to go. Now, it is a refundable credit, and the IRS has Form 7200 out right now. You'll first offset this against your federal withholding deposits that are due, payroll tax deposits that are due, but if the amount of your credit's in excess of that, then you file a Form 7200 and you will be paid the amount of the excess withholding credit. You'll be paid that over. The 7200 also covers the sick leave and family medical leave benefits that were in the prior act. So if you're going to, you know, if you don't have enough withholding taxes and payroll taxes that are being deposited with the feds to offset the entire, to pay for the entire credit, the credit's greater than that, then you can ask the feds for money. You actually fax the form in. Form 7200 is on the IRS website. If you're doing payrolls and this is your situation, that's where you go get it. That's where you send it in. Okay. But remember, you claim a PPP loan at all, this is off the table. Also, there is a rule where you can delay your deposit of the employer old age survivor and disability insurance. Only the 6.2, which is weird. You can't do Medicare. But okay, we'll live with that. You cannot defer if you make use of the Small Business Administration Payroll Protection Program loan forgiveness. So you could take out a PPP loan, But if you decide, oh, I want forgiveness, right, then you have to give this up. If you decide, hey, I don't want forgiveness, I want to get the what's effectively an interest-free loan of the FICA, the employer FICA tax, the employer old age survivor and disability insurance tax, for the rest of 2020, instead of getting the, you know, don't have to pay off the loan, then you could go ahead and pay off your other loan, don't apply for forgiveness, and this will still be available for deferral. It delays the day of deposit only for the 6.2%. So be aware of that. Don't put the Medicare tax in here. Only for the 6.2% and only for the employer portion of the 6.2%. You don't have to pay it for the whole rest of 2020. And it will be due in two parts. One half of it will be due on December 31st, 2021. The other half due on December 31st, 2022. Right? Similar rules are going to apply to one half of the old age survivor and disability insurance portion of the self-employment taxes for 2020. So we're going to reduce that on the 1040, and then we're going to add, you know, though that deferred part, we're going to add half on the 22 return, or half on 21 return, half on the 22 return. Again, if you get loan forgiveness, you cannot do this. We need clarification as to, okay, does this go back to day one if I go for loan forgiveness, or does it, or do I get to defer this up until the day I ask for loan forgiveness? And that's something not clear under the law, something Treasury will apparently have to issue notices on. By the way, Treasury has a lot of things to write, and I should say the IRS people have a lot of guidance, you know, and they're still trying to slog through all of this, so we may not get some of these answers for a while. You know, I'm sure they're prioritizing what needs to get out right now and what comes out later. And, you know, we'll see where this comes out in the mix. That's kind of our summary for this week. Like I said, it's really tough to think about at this point, but we are going to have CPE again this year. Probably a lot of it will be virtual. Let's just be honest. We don't know when everybody could get in the classroom again. We don't know when we're going to be allowed to travel to get the classrooms again, you know, or when societies will want us to travel to get to classrooms again. But even for like courses I'll be doing here in Phoenix, you know, we don't know when they're going to allow people in the room with me. Even if I'm in that room broadcasting, I don't know if they're going to allow other people to be in the room. So obviously that's going to be a trade-off we're going to look at here, you know, as to how we do this. But, you know, we basically, as far as, you know, the CP providers, you know, the state societies and those of us here at Kaplan are definitely getting ready to do these things, you know, take care of them, you know, sending them out remotely as need be and take care of them for you to get your CPE. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of after effects of tax provisions of this that we'll probably want to go over later in the year once, you know, the dust settles some and we got a better idea of what this is and potentially the coronavirus bill number 4, which is now being openly talked about by both Senator McConnell and Speaker Pelosi. So my guess is we will see a number 4 and we will see it sooner rather than later. And who knows what tax rates will be in there, but consider your state societies. People ask me all the time, you know, why should I pay to be a member of a state society? You know, why should I be pay to be a member of the AICPA? What do they do for me? Gang, these past couple of weeks tell you what they do for you. You know, the state society has been offering tons of guidance and pointing you to places and getting stuff on this. State societies hosting message boards. You know, we have had just a ton of activity on the Connect sites in Arizona and New Jersey going over this law. We have had, you know, all kinds of information. This stuff is now and coming out to you. As a member of the state societies, you're getting this stuff. And in a number of cases, you're getting it without paying anything extra for it. And this is happening while those societies are having to work outside their office and arrange things, you know, without being able to work the way they're used to working. So, gang, this is why you do it. You want to know the whys, this is the why. And I want to remind people of this the next time somebody asks me that question, because I do get asked from time to time. And, yeah, this is why. Also, the state societies are where the governors tend to turn to when they start asking about things like, you know, pushing for payroll, pushing for extensions on due dates. We had a big issue with that. I think virtually every state now has gotten their April, I think all states now have their April 15th due dates pushed back. Not all of them have their extensions pushed back. But the state societies, every state society I know has been involved with the state revenue departments and the governor's office in trying to get that fashioned and get that relief out there and push for it happening. I know it was true both in New Jersey and Arizona. I was following both of those. And the state societies were deeply involved in getting those things going. So this is it. Yeah, this is why you do it. And the AICPAs is right now still involved in trying to get some standardization on what exactly are payroll costs. You know, guys, we need to standardize this now instead of having, you know, it depend on which bank you go to. So yeah, those are why we do it. Okay. Now, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments in a kind of unusual format for the week of April, I gotta remember the days these days, April the 6th of 2020. You lose track of days now. Not what I was expecting to do. You know, I expected this might be my last broadcast before tax season, because next week on April 13th, it'd be like, well, I'm gonna be too busy dealing with client stuff to get one of these out. Well, looks like I might be able to do something next week. You know, we'll take a look, we'll see what's happening, because we'll probably have even more updates, and I'll probably continue on with trying to update you on any guidance we've had on these main issues and go back to the standard routines, you know, once we actually start getting some additional guidance, and maybe once guidance calms down a bit and these things start coming out a little simpler. But I thought going over today where we stand on these key issues was really important. Now, again, remember, anything you hear, it's now 10 till 10 here in Phoenix, which means 9:50 a.m. on Mountain Standard Time, which is the same as Pacific Daylight Time. You guys play with your clocks, just, yeah. Well, most of you probably are playing with your clocks, so remember that. So anything that happened actually after 50 minutes ago, I don't know about, because I've been on here doing this. So make sure you double check that. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'm on Twitter at edzollers. That has been an amazing resource, Tax Twitter. There are lots of things. That's where I find out everything that tends to happen as soon as it happens. So if you've not looked into Twitter and Tax Twitter, I realize it is a crazy, don't get in the politics side of it, ignore that. But if you go and follow the real tax people, call it tearing on posting tax stuff, you're going to find some very useful things and people that tell you as soon as something happens. You can also follow discussions. I do those on Reddit at /r/taxpros, and I post on the various state societies. You know, so we see, if, you know, that I'm a member of. I'm a member here in Arizona, Minnesota, New Jersey. They've been extremely active posts in the Connect sites for Arizona and New Jersey as all of these developments have happened over the past week. If your state society has an active discussion group, be sure to get involved in it if you've not looked at it there. Right now, it may seem overwhelming, but there's a lot of information given to you that comes out when things happen. So you want to make sure you're checking there. Okay, time to just calm down, take your breath. You know, we're working through this. Our clients, you know, we're working to help our clients, working to help keep, you know, help these things take care of. And, you know, we've been drafted as part of the people who are going to be assisting in trying to get this program through. We're the people to kind of, you know, work things through with them. So be aware of that. Be aware that there's a lot of things we don't have answers to. And be careful that you understand the limits of your knowledge. You're an accountant, you know, and you're a tax specialist. You're not a banker, right? You're not a lawyer. You're not an HR person. So, you know, you got to say that some of this stuff is that area, and we'll talk with them. But those people have the same problem, that a lot of their answers are going to involve tax law. You know, what people are asking them involves some answers that will require some tax law judgment or some accounting judgment. So we all going to kind of get to work together on this, and we should get through it. Hopefully your clients who are applying for these loans will be able to get everything taken care of. So by a week from now, this will all be a nice, smoothly operating program, we hope, you know, and we'll be on to other things. But in any event, take care. Have a, you know, be safe this week, and we will talk to you probably next week. See what's happened and see where we stand a week from now on current federal tax developments.